Keep running! What are you doing?
Did anybody just see that? Over there! I don't see anything!
What are we looking for?
Go! Go!
It's a ghost!
Go! Let's go!
It can't be.
We have to get out of here! Everyone move!
Go!
Faster!
Let's go!
Nobody move!
Simon, what?
I said everybody stop!
Stop! Okay, stop!
Nobody move!
That's not a ghost!
Are you crazy?
I love Peter's words in that passage that comes from the TV show The Chosen, the third season, but it comes straight out of Scripture, Matthew chapter 14. I love what Peter says, and I wonder if some of us have said the same thing multiple times in our life, maybe even just today. See, Peter calls out because he's in a place, and he's in a place where he doesn't know what he has to hold on to. And so Peter says to Jesus, if you are who you say you are, then do something. If you are who you say you are, then do something. You see, the thing that about that situation that's so fascinating is the only reason that those disciples are in that boat. Get this. The only reason they found themselves in that boat, in that water, at that time was because Jesus told them to get into it. And so they're thinking to themselves, if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be in here. And we've left everything to follow you. We're doing all of the things that you're asking us to do. No, we're not doing it perfectly, but we're trying our best. And now we're here in a moment where we're beyond ourselves. And we need you, Jesus, and we need you to be who you say that you claim to be. We need you to move. We need you to do something. Have you ever felt like that before? Like in faith, in your life, when you're encountering something, when you're in a place where you feel incredibly adrift and you're like, my goodness, I've said all the prayers, I've prayed all the prayers, I've done all the things, and it seems as if all I'm getting is at best silence. And I don't even know what to say anymore. I don't know what to do. I remember when I was young, it was about fifth grade. My family was a family that had a lake cabin. That was just what we did. The water, the lake, that was normal to us. It was so normal to us. We didn't always take the precautions probably that we needed to take. One of my best friends, his name was Chris, and I always wanted Chris to come to the lake cabin with me, but Chris's parents would never let him come to the lake because they weren't lake people. They weren't water people. And so all the times when we were going to the lake, I'd be like, hey, Chris, can you come out to the lake with us this weekend? And he'd say, no, I can't. Well, finally, fifth grade, his parents said yes. And I remember going to Chris's house, and I remember being there and my parents picking Chris up. And I remember Chris coming out of the house with his big duffel bag. And I remember talking to his mom, Carolyn. And his mom, Carolyn, said, just promise me that you guys won't do anything that's dumb. Like, no, we'd never do anything that's dumb. We'll always wear a life jacket. We won't even come close to the water without parental supervision. We would never do anything like that. So we take the hour trip to get to our lake cabin. And the first thing we do when we get there, like we had a whole car to unpack, but the first thing that we did is we bolted for the water. And I was like, hey, Chris, you got to check out this fishing boat that we had that had a 6-horse Evinrude on it. I'm like, we got to go in the, you've heard about this boat, but we got to go in the boat. And we can go so fast, which like tops out at like 3 miles an hour, but we can go so fast. And Chris is like, are you sure we should go? Are you sure it's okay? I'm like, yeah, I'll be fine. What could go wrong? So Chris and I, we get in the boat and we're just flying. We're going across the water. I'm going as far away from the cabin as I can go, going across the lake into the bigger bay. We're as far away as we could go. And I'm with, it's one of those motors that you have to like turn the throttle on it. So I'm just here on the back bench looking forward. Chris is in the front bench and he's looking backward. And what he sees unfolding is like, really, it's a light show because a storm's coming. And Chris told me, he's like, hey, Jeremy, it's kind of getting dark back there. I'm like, Chris, we'll be fine. Don't worry about it. And then it didn't turn from a light, it wasn't just a light show. Then all of a sudden it was like a lightning bolt show. And Chris is like, hey, man, we have to get back. So we're about as far away from the cabin as we could be. And I turned the boat around and there's one thing I realized that I didn't check before we got into the boat. It was how much gas we had. Yeah, I know. It was awful. And so the boat completely runs out of gas. And he's like, what are we going to do? And I'm sitting there pulling on the ripcord thinking like, somehow I'm going to will this thing to start. I'm going to will myself through the situation. But nothing happens. And Chris is like, well, do you have any oars? I'm like, yes, we have oars. But they're in the cabin right now. And in my mind, first thing I'm thinking is Chris is never going to be able to come to the lake again. But two, like I'm fifth grade perspective, I'm like, we're going to die. My parents don't know where we are. We're floating in the middle of a storm. And if there's any place that you don't want to be in the middle of a storm, is in a metal boat in the middle of the water. And that's exactly where we were. And maybe that's kind of metaphorically exactly where you feel that you are right now. Like you have no power to get you where it is that you need to go for safety. And you start to wonder if that's even possible. And it's in those moments, and it's in those cries and in those calls where we say, God, if you are who you say you are, that sometimes we start to question the existence or the reality of God, don't we? It's natural. It's normal. It's okay. We all do. It's biblical. Psalm 13. Oh Lord, how long are you going to forget about me? How long will you look the other way? How long must I struggle? How long until you're going to be who you claim that you are? So it's so important about these letters that Paul writes to the early church, because he's writing to real people who are experiencing real things. So we've been going through the God's Electric Power Company as we've been looking through Galatians and Ephesians and Philippians. Next week we'll walk through Colossians, but specifically Jamie and I today we're going to look at Paul's letter to the church in Philippi, where Paul writes, and he writes to people and gives them a way to find joy and peace in a world that can feel very, very adrift. But in order to do that, we need to know the context to which Paul's writing from. Because if you're anything like me, you're like, well, yeah, it's easy for somebody like Paul to say stuff like that. Because, I mean, he writes 2/3 of the New Testament. It must have been easy for Paul. When we start to dig into the context, we realize that it's quite different than that.
So as we take a look at the context of who Paul is writing to and where Paul is writing from, these scripture verses light up for us in a different way. So let's take a look at who Paul is writing to. He's writing to the church in Philippi. And the incredible thing about this church is that this is the first church that Paul had established in Europe. So you can read all about Paul's missionary journeys throughout the book of Acts, where he's essentially going to the ends of the earth to talk about who Jesus is. And he goes all the way to Philippi, which in modern day geography is just below Bulgaria. It's in Macedonia, it's in Greece, and you can see an artist's rendering of ancient Philippi. It's currently in ruins. You can go and walk around it and visit it and take a look. And so it's set up against these hills. You can see the farmland around it. And the interesting thing about Philippi is that Alexander the Great's father, Philip, had conquered this area, named this city after himself, and the people that were here were a really interesting blend. There were farmers and peasants that lived in this community, slaves, their servants. They lived in this community. And also, this is where the retired military would go After they were done with their service, this is where the veterans would settle, is in ancient Philippi. And so this community is a part of the church that Paul then is writing to as he writes this letter. So you can read about it in the book of Acts when Paul goes, his first missionary, there's an interesting story. Second missionary journey, he meets a woman named Lydia. And you can see Paul and Lydia here in this stained glass window in a church that was built not too long ago on the site of where Paul supposedly met Lydia. So she's the first woman in the area who converts to Christianity. It's thought that maybe, just maybe, Paul builds this church in Philippi around Lydia and her family. She and her family are baptized by Paul. And so this is the audience that is understanding and hearing this letter that Paul writes. And Paul's, as we've looked at this morning, he's got a ton of letters that he writes to all these different churches, but there are some greatest hits that come specifically from this letter. It appears that Paul has a really great relationship with this church in Philippi. And he writes, "For me to live is Christ and to die is gain." There's this beautiful song and poem that he quotes in Philippians 2 that even though Jesus was God, he did not consider equality with God as something to be grasped, but instead made himself a servant. So that hits a little bit different when you know who Paul is writing to. And then last but not least, "I can do all things through him who strengthens me," Paul writes at the end of this 4-chapter letter. And that verse alone will look really different for all of us this morning by the end of this message. But the most important piece of context that you need to know, far beyond anything else, is where Paul is writing from. He's not writing from the beach. He's not writing from a castle or a high tower. Tucked away into safety. He's behind bars. Paul is in prison. In his missionary journeys, as he's been talking about Jesus, he pushed a lot of buttons and a lot of people were really upset with him. So he's writing without his freedom. And he writes about things like joy and peace, and he addresses worry. And it's really important for us as we look at these themes that Paul is writing about today, that we know where he's writing from, because that will change everything for us. Jeremy, tell us what he says about joy.
Philippians 4, you heard at the very beginning of the scripture passage that was just read. He says, "Always be full of joy in the Lord. And I say it again, rejoice." And I think a lot of us, maybe it's just me, but I think a lot of us have heard that over the years. And so that seems to be detached from reality. Does Paul not know the circumstances of life? When we know that Paul's writing from prison, it's a whole lot different. I think one of the things that makes this whole statement and this whole proclamation, this truth, "always be full of joy in the Lord, I'll say it again, rejoice," what makes it so difficult is we've mistaken the difference between joy and happiness. We equate them as being quite similar to one another. When I was in college, I was an English major, and so one of the classes that I had to take as an English major was a class called Development of the English Language. It actually was one of my favorite classes in college. And the thing that made it so interesting is because we studied the language that you and I use today and how it became what it is. And the interesting thing about the English language, and those of you who aren't native English speakers, you know this, that English is a very difficult language because it's pulled from so many different places. There are so many words that we have that some have a Latin origin and some of them have an Old English origin, and some of them have a French origin. And so we have all of these words that come together. And so sometimes we don't actually know the root, or we forget the root, or we've never known the root of what a word truly means. And so when we look at happiness, we see that happiness is completely separate from joy. Happiness comes from the Old English word hap, which literally means chance, fortune, or luck. Happenstance. It's just a chance. It's just some sort of fortune or luck. And so when things go well, we have good fortune or we have good luck. It's dependent on momentary external circumstances. I think about it this way. My favorite team to watch in any sports is the Minnesota Twins. I absolutely love them. When I was a fifth grader, it was 1987, the Minnesota Twins, they won the World Series. I actually got to go to Game 7, and it was one of the wildest moments of my life. I was so incredibly happy. 4 years later, 1991, they did it again. And since then, we've done nothing. We've done absolutely nothing. And statistically speaking, if you look over the course of my lifetime, the twins have been just under a 500 team, meaning, historically speaking, they've lost more games than they've won. And so I watched these games, and I watched it every single night. It happened last night. We went up 2-0 early, and I thought, it's all right. And then we lost. And I looked at the TV. I'm like, I hate this team. I hate these teams. I'm never watching this team again. And my wife is like, I wish you wouldn't. But because everything changes. I get mad. I get grumpy. The day before, they rolled. And it was, I'm like, I love this team. It's so much fun. I can't wait to read the newspaper in the morning. Everything's good. And she's like, why don't you unhitch your train from the cart that you're following? Because you're miserable. Because your happiness is dependent on what your team does. Thank goodness none of you can relate to that at all. Maybe it's not just your team. Maybe it's something else. Maybe it's something that is very good and it's very well intentioned and it has a lot of great attributes to it. But you know, intellectually, you know it's not going to last. That's why joy is so important. Joy is entirely different. It comes from the Greek word chara, which means, it literally means a deep, an inner, an untouchable gladness. Do you have that? Greek word chara is the same root that we get the Greek word charis, which means grace. Grace is this gift that's been given to us, offered to us, that we just need to open our hearts to say yes to. That's independent of external circumstances. I remember about 7 years ago, I was able to go to Haiti to visit one of our mission partners that works over in that area. And a lot of people will say if we have third world countries in the world, that Haiti is a fourth world country. Poverty is just incredible. And so we had done a project as a church, some of you remember it, where we were putting concrete floors in different homes in Haiti. And so we got to go over there and pray over some of the houses that had received your generosity. And so we were doing that. And I'll never forget this one woman that was there. And I honestly, like, she was maybe 80 pounds. She was about 70 years old, which, you know, in our terminology, you know, 70, that's not old at all. But in Haitian terms, because of the quality of life, that's quite advanced in years. Her husband had passed away, her kids had moved away, so she literally had nothing. And I remember hugging this woman and feeling like I was just hugging a bag of bones. And I remember asking her, how can I be praying for you? And you want to know what she said to me? She said, oh, sweetheart, I don't need your prayers. I have all that I need. Reserve your prayers for someone who doesn't. She had joy. Untouchable. Outside looking in, we would have seen this woman as being desperate. She looked at her life as being abundant. See this play out over the last few weeks as we've been watching the wildfires that have been just wreaking havoc over in Maui. The pastor of a church over there, and he said, when he was asked about the reality of his circumstance, he'd lost 3 to 4 people in his life. They had lost their lives due to the fire. His church building, the community around him had all been devastated, and they asked him, like, where do you go? How do you move on? Where do you go from here? And his response is, he said, well, if Peter can walk on water, so can we. Somehow, some way, because of God's goodness and God's grace, we will make it to the shore. That's what Paul knew. That no matter what his current circumstance was, no matter how gridlocked the prison doors were, he still had freedom. He still had joy. Always be full of joy in the Lord. I'll say it again, rejoice. It's what Nehemiah says. We read through this a couple months ago as a church, as we read through the book of Nehemiah. And Nehemiah, God had called Nehemiah to go back to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem had been devastated. And so Nehemiah is building the walls back to protect the city once again, God's holy city. And as they were building the wall, they came across God's law, his gift to humanity. And they were reading the law out loud, and they realized how far they had gone astray as a community. And so people started to weep. And Nehemiah, God says through Nehemiah to the people, don't be dejected and sad. Oh, our current circumstance might not be the way that God would intend it to be, but don't be dejected or sad, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. Do you have that? Is that the undercurrent of your life, or are there other things that have begun to pull you in opposite directions? This is why Paul's letter, and Paul's specifically this part of Paul's letter, is so incredibly important.
So as Paul is hitting this bullet point list at this point in the letter of what to do, what to avoid, he says this after talking about joy: don't worry about anything, but instead pray about everything. And this is so key for us to take a look at and understand what Paul is really saying, because if we don't, it can easily turn into a cliche that we throw around. Don't worry, just pray. And I don't know about you, but if you've ever been in a state of worry like I quite frequently have, it's almost as if the people who tell you stop worrying feel as if they're the first person to ever tell you that. Like, oh, I didn't realize that I could stop worrying by just stopping worrying. That's amazing. But that's not what Paul is saying here at all. There's actually layers and beauty to what he's talking about here. And it's really important for us to know, because worry is a place where we just spin. We've got a situation or a person that we're thinking about, that we're concerned about. And the thing that strikes me about worry is that we don't worry about it if we're not invested somehow. Like, there's a person or a situation that we care deeply about, and that's where usually that worry starts, is out of a place of care or concern. That care and concern is great. It's just that the worry can spiral sometimes. So Paul uses this word merimnao for worry, and it comes from, so this is the verb, this is the noun, merimna. And it means to be drawn in different directions or divided, almost as if being drawn in different directions yourself at the same time, or to be divided against yourself, to go to pieces through being pulled apart or distracted. And it feels to me as if Paul is describing a death trap, I mean a merry-go-round. And if you remember this thing from the playground, I loved merry-go-rounds. I was the kid that not only liked to be in the middle of the merry-go-round or the first layer of handholds, but I loved to be right out here on the edge, hanging on for dear life, yelling, faster, faster, and sometimes would even lay down and stick my head off of the edge and avoid decapitation as someone is making that merry-go-round go faster and faster. I absolutely loved it. But if you've been on the merry-go-round around on the outside for a while, you know that you can't do that for very long, because what happens if you're out there for more than just a couple spins? You start to get a little bit sick. And isn't that just like worry? Worry, when we're in the middle, sometimes it feels like we've got control over it, but the farther we go out to that edge, man, that can be a dangerous place to be if we live there and if we just spin and worry and fret about the things that we have on our mind. This is really important to Paul. He uses the imperative tense in the Greek language, and the imperative tense, when we're talking about words, means that it's a command. He says, do not worry. This isn't a suggestion. There's no a question about it. And Paul is echoing the exact same words that Jesus uses in the New Testament, in Matthew and in Luke and the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain, where Jesus says, look at the lilies of the field. Look at these sparrows. God takes care of them and takes care of their needs. God loves them. How much more will God take care of you? So do not worry. That's Jesus. And Paul is just simply echoing what Jesus says here. When you worry, when you're on this merry-go-round spin, you're going to go to pieces through being pulled apart. It reminds me of a story of when I was doing student ministry after college. I grew up here in Iowa, moved to Seattle, and did student ministry with a friend's dad at a church out there. And there was one summer that we took these students to the beach, to the ocean, for a beach retreat. And these kids had grown up around water. They know exactly what they're doing. They're like the little Jeremies of the world. They know how to handle themselves around on water. And As always, though, when you're taking kids and students to a place, you remind them of the boundaries and here's where you can go, here's where you can't go. And there was a flag on the beach this one particular day that warned people about rip currents. Rip currents are this really fast-moving piece of water, bit of water, that if you're not careful, can just suck you in and carry you out. And not even Olympic swimmers would be able to outswim something as powerful as a rip current. So we told everybody, you got to be careful. Well, we had one student that just really always loved to play with fire, and I would always say, Jason, is this a good idea or a bad idea? And he would like roll his eyes and chuckle, and he was like, this is a bad idea. But he always loved to live around on the edges of the merry-go-round. And so there was this moment where I realized I couldn't see Jason anymore, started scanning, looking everywhere for him, and it turns out that he's a tiny little dot out in the ocean just bobbing, and he's actually yelling for help. But it's so faint, we can barely hear him. So emergency vehicles show up. A couple people from the beach run out into the water. But one of the terrible parts about rip currents is that if you run into the water to try to save somebody else, there's nothing stopping you yourself from getting caught in the rip current. So for those of us on the beach watching with our hearts in our throats, there wasn't really much we could do outside of pray. Pray that this was going to be okay. And Jason ended up being fine. He was saved and brought back to safety. But the thing about this undertow or this rip current is there's this point at which when you're in the water that you can stand and you can be okay, that the waves are not big enough that they can pull you out. But if you go out far enough, you become endangered. And that's the thing about worry is we can have concerns. We can have things that we think about and think our way around to try to solve, manage, take care of. But there's a certain point at which worry can just take us out to sea. And that is what Paul is writing to warn this church in Philippi about. Don't get sucked in. Joyce Meyer has this beautiful quote. There's a similar quote attributed to a lot of different people. I like the way she worded this. Worry is a down payment on a problem that you may never have. How true is that? When we're worrying about worst case scenario and maybe this is going to happen and what about if that happens, if we spend our God-given emotion and energy and time and all of these good things that God has given us, spending our time worrying about all that, it may never actually come to pass. And so the perspective that Paul is bringing all of us to here from prison as he writes about worry and joy is this. Paul knows that worry emphasizes the situation where we just hover and spin on what's going to happen. What am I going to do? Prayer, however, totally flips that. Prayer emphasizes the solution and, more importantly, the God who solves our problems and saves. So when Paul writes this whole verse here, this really helps us to shift our perspective on what he's writing from prison. Don't worry about anything. Instead, pray about everything. Tell God what you need and thank him for all he has done. And I love the way that Eugene Peterson translates this in the message. Don't fret or worry. Instead of worrying, pray. Let petitions and prayers shape your worries into prayers, letting God know your concerns. Before you know it, a sense of God's wholeness, everything coming together for good, will come and settle you down. It's wonderful what happens when Christ displaces worry at the center of your life. I don't know if Paul ever was on a merry-go-round, but it's as if he knows that living out here on the edge might be fun for a minute, but it's going to make us not feel super great for the long term. The best place to be on a merry-go-round, other than off of a merry-go-round, is right here in the middle, at the center. When you're in the middle, things are a little bit more balanced. You're a little bit more secure. Yes, there's still stuff swirling, but at least you have a sense of peace. Jeremy, how do we get that peace?
It sounds like it's the church answer. It's like if you asked any question in a Sunday school class, like, how do you do this? They'd be like, Jesus. You're like, okay, at least you tell me what you want to hear. And the answer is Jesus. But it's not just Jesus because it's pie in the sky. It's not just Jesus because we feel like it's the right answer. It's Jesus because of who he is and because of what he's done. The disciples were in that boat, and the storm was raging, and Jesus makes his way to them. This is going to be a pattern that exists all throughout Scripture. Anytime humanity was distant, anytime humanity felt far, God came near. Don't ever forget that. Anytime you might feel far, you might feel distant, you might feel that God is far, you might feel that God is distant, He will come near. He is coming. He doesn't expect you to get to Him. He comes to you. Jesus says to the disciples, don't be afraid. Take courage because I am here. The world would see Paul, and the people that heard Paul in prison, they didn't have words to describe this peace that he had, because everything around him, the external realities of Paul's life, would indicate anything but peace. But Paul is telling all of these people, he's recognizing his position, he's recognizing his place, and he also knows that it won't last forever. Isn't that the thing that storms rob us of? I think we could just park there for a minute. We find ourselves in this place, this situation in our lives, and we kind of convince ourselves, because we're human, that this is just going to be the way it's going to be forever. It won't. It can't. Because nothing lasts forever except for faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of those three is love. And it's the love that God has for you. That's what Paul knew. So Paul says, because of that, because I can find joy in the eternal things of life, that God has saved me by His grace, because I can take my worries and my needs, I can shape them into prayers, I can tell God exactly what I need, and I can thank God for all that He has done. Because of that, then I can experience God's peace, which exceeds anything we can understand. His peace, not our ability to try to quiet the waters around us, because I think sometimes we think that peace is only possible when we can experience tranquility. Is that even a reality? If you've had kids around you, you know that that lasts for like 5 minutes at best. And then all of a sudden chaos can ensue. Peace isn't the absence of storms. Peace is holding on to Jesus in the middle of them. Peace is knowing that He was the God who left the 99 in pursuit of the one. Peace is understanding that as Paul wrote to the church in Rome, that there's nothing in all of creation that could ever. There's no storm in life. There's no thing that we could do. There's no thing that we could left undone. There's nothing we could say, nothing that we could withhold from saying that could ever separate us from the love of God that's revealed to us in the God who is the calmer of the storms. Peter's in the boat and he's saying, if it is you, then do something. And what happens in that moment, it doesn't just change Peter's life in the moment. It doesn't just change the disciples' lives in the moment. It doesn't change just Peter's life for eternity, and it doesn't change just the disciples' lives for eternity. It changes ours as well, because we see the character, the nature, and the power of God. Take a look.
Why are you chasing after Gentiles when your own people have problems right here? When your own person has problems? I've been right here in front of you, believing in you, but you're breaking up fights in the Decapolis?
Then come to me, you weary and heavy laden. I will give you rest.
Simon!
I gave up everything to follow you. But your healing told of strangers.
Keep your eyes on me.
I love what Peter says there. Don't let me go. Don't let me go. I think we've all found ourselves in a boat that's been adrift before, haven't we? In fact, I'm quite certain that there are many of us who are here today that find ourselves in the middle of that boat. I know it because in the last week I've done three funerals. Like, life happens. In this side of heaven, life's not perfect. And we face it. I mean, I literally, in hindsight, it's 2020. Now I know it was okay, but I physically can remember being in that boat with Chris. And both of us were looking at each other and realizing, like, this is terrible. And then I remember hearing the sound of a boat motor. And it was my dad who was in our big boat, and he was flying. Like, my dad, usually he was Captain Cautious. Like, you know, when you go on the inner tube, you want the crazy driver on the inner tube. My dad would be like, I can take you on the inner tube. We'd be like, no, please, Mom, let her take us. Because my dad would maybe go 10 miles an hour and do nice and gentle. My dad was flying. He's like, hey! Hey! And the storm was going. And I've thought about that so many times in my life and thought to myself, would I have done that? I don't tell my kids I asked that question, but would I have done that? Put myself in the face of danger to find the ones who foolishly went adrift? Whatever boat it is that you find yourself in here today or any day, don't forget the one who comes to you, who left heaven, literally left heaven for you. The infinite became finite for you. The God of the universe took on flesh and was beaten, and he was nailed to a cross for you, for me, so that we would have someone to hold on to. When the storm waves died, the disciples looked at each other and they were amazed. And they weren't so amazed that the storm wasn't raging, because they knew that there was going to be another time on that body of water that the storm was going to come again. Look, here's the promise. It's not like, hold on to Jesus, you'll never get adrift again. You will. But hold on to Jesus, because he is the Son of God. He is the God of all peace. He is the God of all eternity. This is what the theologian N.T. Wright says. He said, the peace of God will be with you. Because why? Because the peace of God is with you. Through the power of the Holy Spirit, the peace of God resides inside of you. Paul writes it this way in the closing part of this powerful passage in Philippians. He said, I've learned the secret of living in every situation, whether my stomach is full or whether it's empty, whether I have a lot or whether I have a little, whether I am imprisoned or whether I am free. I can do all things through Jesus Christ who strengthens me, who gives me strength. You weren't designed to live life on your own power, because a storm's going to come and you're going to run out of gas. But the God of the universe sees you and considers you worth it and saves you and says, let me be the fuel that you run your lives on. Because my power can give you joy and give you peace, even in moments where life isn't going the way that it's supposed to. Don't miss it. Hold on to that. We're going to sing a song as we close, and it's a song that was written by Hope Worship. It's a newer song, and it's an incredible prayer. So I'm going to invite you to stand. We're going to sing this song as our prayer before we go home. And these words are words that we hold on to. And if you're in a place where you feel like you're in the middle of a storm, let other people's singing, let their proclamation cascade over you to fill you with the strength and the hope that comes from Jesus.